Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder. We're going to be talking about all the good stuff that we like to hear, building, scaling, financing, and all the above. We're going to be talking about putting all your savings into your business, you know, taking your company out of almost bankruptcy into really scaling it and going in rocket ship mode. And then also, you know, how they dealt with, for example, getting funding from some of the best VCs or even surviving COVID. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Steven Tsao. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up? Because I know that even though you were born in China, you came to the US to San Francisco quite early in your life.
Yeah, immigrant parents. I came when I was 1 year old. I grew up in San Francisco and pretty much have a pretty standard upbringing. Went to college in UCSD, studying electrical engineering. But during that time, I found my passion in game development, started making games, selling them online. And I built my first company out of my own dormitory. And after I graduated, I went to Hong Kong and first created a PC mobile game company and went from there.
So how did you get into the whole gaming thing? Because I know that was during the college years, but how did you get into it?
I love playing games. I grew up on Mario, Zelda, and Final Fantasy. So I wanted to see, well, I want to create my own games and I want to be able to kind of, you know, I love the whole creative process of it. And it just became, a passion hobby of mine that eventually became something I could actually make money from. And it was timed very well because internet gaming was taking off. So, you know, independent studios were just popping up left and right, including myself.
So then tell us about how the first company came together.
So one day we were building games. I was working with a publisher and I realized I need to start, growing my team. We were making a little bit of money and I decided, you know what, why don't I try doing this in another country? So in 2009, I packed my bags and went to Hong Kong. And at that time, I hired, two artists to help me out. And within the course of 4 years, it grew to a team of 45 people building PC mobile games.
So then tell us about how were you guys making money there? What was the monetization model? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, the way it works is people go to a website and they'll try a game for an hour. And if they like it, they will pay probably between $6 to $20 to play the full version of the game. And each of our titles are usually around, 6 to 10 hours long. So we'll have a team that will create, two titles every year. And just create that cadence. And we would build really deep stories and sequels and just stuff like that.
So whatever happened, with the company, because as they say, you either succeed or you learn. And in this case, it was big lessons, to be learned. And you ended up winding down the operation. So why? What happened?
So we did very well for PC games. And I felt like I got a bit too comfortable when mobile came along. I ignored it. I thought that, there weren't going to be enough people to play games on the phone until when I realized that it was too late, that, when we decided to go into mobile, we were faced with fierce competition. We didn't have the necessary skill set or the knowledge on how to tackle the mobile industry. So for the, following 3 years of, trying to make it work in the mobile industry, we weren't able to succeed. I went from a team of 45 just down to a team of 5 by the end of 2016. And the learning lesson I had was you should never build games on what's popular today, because by the time you're done 9 months later, it's going to be old news. Your job is to figure out what people want in the next year or so.
So at what point did it become apparent that it was time to pull the plug? You were 10 years in. So, it's not easy.
It was around 2015. That was our biggest game that we've ever done. And we've even gotten support from Apple. They featured our title. But even with that in mind, we were not able to turn a profit from that title. And I felt like we've done everything we could with the resources that we had. And we were fighting against companies with more and more resources. So We're like, okay, that's it. I'm going to need to wind this company down.
What was that roller coaster of emotions like for you? Because, I mean, it's not like a couple of months project, you know, over almost a decade there, you know, pushing this forward. I mean, what was that like for you of just being at peace with it?
I think it was definitely a slow burn because it was a pretty drawn out 4-year process to make mobile work. I mean, personally for me, because I've been building games since college, it was, you know, I think a realization is maybe for the first time, I'm not good at what I'm doing. And that was very tough because I built my identity around building really great games. And for a time period, we're doing really well because of that. So it brought a lot of introspection and, you know, a lot of uncertainty and a lot of lack of confidence, kind of like ending 2015.
So at what point, you know, obviously you ended up putting the plug on this, but at what point, you know, does the idea of Sandvox VR, you know, come knocking?
It was, you know, funny thing, it was also in 2015. I think that was, you know, one of many lucky breaks I had, because at that time, the VR industry was blowing up. In 2014, Facebook bought Oculus. In 2015 and 2016, the first commercial headsets were available, the PlayStation headset, the Oculus headset, and HTC Vive. So there was a lot of buzz around that time. And for me, because I knew how to build games, you know, I figured, is this another opportunity to try something new? VR was this brand new medium that no one knew about. And for me, it felt like a redemption because my mistake of being late in mobile could be redeemed by being very, very early in VR. So what I've done was I told my team that was remaining, say, hey, I'm going to start a new company. I think it's worth fighting for, you know, to try to build a new future in VR. And then luckily, I also have a group of friends who believed in that vision. And they told me, if you start a new company, we'll invest in you. And that's actually how the company was formed. It was formed by a group of friends who all pitched in a little bit of money to get this company off the ground.
So then for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Sandvox VR? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so Sandvox VR is we open physical retail locations where you can book tickets online to play any of our experiences. So we have original titles that we built, like zombie experiences, but we also work with branded titles. So we've lately partnered with Netflix to bring Squid Game and also Zack Snyder's Rebel Moon inside Sandvox. We have 47 locations today with over 100,000 customers coming in every month. So the short of it is, inside Sandvox, you are basically inside this immersive world where you can embody the character and play a narrative journey with you and your friends. You can physically interact with each other and you can have this very high intense moment.
So then at what point do you realize, hey, I think we are into something here? At what point did it feel like you guys were turning a corner? Because I know that you were literally putting all your savings into this thing until you guys were able to hit product market fit.
Well, certainly not in the beginning. When we really started building our Sandvox, it was in 2016, you know, with fresh funding from my friends. We actually pivoted. In the beginning, we started with just building games for the Quest and for the HTC Vive, just like a lot of VR studio. But my learning lesson from the mobile days was never build for the current, always build for the future. So when we thought deeply about it, we felt the future was like the Matrix, right? So you can physically interact with one another in this large space and play these highly immersive experiences. And that's just not something that can be done in your living room. There's a constraint of space, but there's also limited by just a headset alone will not give you that outcome. And even if you reduce, you know, the cost of the headset, improve the technology, over the next 10 years, you still won't get there. So that was the moment we realized that we have to build something outside of home. And that really sucks for us because I know nothing about retail, you know, 7 years ago. And I don't know how hard it was. I didn't know how to even start it, but I knew that this was the future. So we've actually separated to a separate project where we built the infrastructure to enable this Matrix experience, which is, how can you physically play an experience where you can touch a friend's shoulder in VR and actually physically touch them in real life. That's how you create the deep immersion. So what happened was in the end of 2016, when we launched our first VR consumer game, it was like a top 10% game, but the market wasn't big enough. So we ended up losing money on that project. And we felt, oh man, this is going to be very difficult to make it work. And that was true for many VR developers. So in 2017, we put our eggs into this like location-based project. But in 2017, it was also known as the winter of VR. Because after Christmas, people realized that not many headsets were sold. And those that were sold were not very retentive. People use it and they put it on the shelves and they leave it alone. So VC did not want to invest in VR in 2017. And that was when we needed the money. The money that I raised for my friend, it wasn't that much. So we went out and pitched. And we've gotten a few things that really was very difficult for us. Number one was, you know, you're basically doing retail, you're doing VR, and you're doing content. Three things that VCs don't want to invest in, and you're doing all of them together. So that was very hard. And, you know, because my team was formed in Hong Kong, the geography was also really difficult because they didn't know we have the talent necessary to do that. And number three, you know, we were not the only company doing, you know, outside of home VR. The biggest company raised $50 million with a team of probably 50 to 100 people. We were just a team of 6 people. How are you going to beat them? Right. So we had so many stuff against us at that time. And we only had about 3 months of runway left, you know, starting in 2017. So I told myself, okay, the only way to make this work is if I basically took my life savings and reinvested back into the company. And before I'd done that, you know, I talked to my friends, I talked to my parents. I was like, hey, should I do this? And, you know, all of them said, no, you know, save the money, do something else, continue your life, you know, get married. Don't dump everything into the company because it's very hard. You've done your best already. But a part of me felt that, you know, this was going to be the future. You know, I genuinely felt that people wanted this. Because it's highly immersive, it's very social, and I think people will get really meaningful connection out of this. So I didn't listen to any of them. I just put all the money that I had into the company, and I told my team, hey, I only have 6 months left. This is all the money I have. Should we all fight for it? If you disagree, I'll just disband the company, but if we all fight for it, let's do it. So luckily, my team all agreed to fight for it, and then we decided to take basically the concept that we had at that time and bring it to market.
How many people were on the team at that point?
It was 6 people. We have to build the technology infrastructure that enables full body play with a group of people. And because it was a brand new platform, we also have to create our own content on top of that. And because this only happens outside of home, we also have to build a retail center.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So With that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And how was the journey to of raising money? Because you guys have been able to raise money from top VCs. So I guess first question is, how much capital have you guys raised in total? And then what was the journey of raising the money?
Yeah, in total, including venture debt, we raised almost $100 million today. But, you know, at that time in 2017, how do we get to that journey was kind of fast forward 6 months. We launched our first location in Hong Kong. And then right off the bat, you know, we launched it. We got picked up by a media and it went viral. And we sold out 100 days worth of tickets from morning to night. And, you know, nothing sells like traction. And that's when we got our first institutional VC. That was GoBVC/Alibaba Hong Kong Fund. They came in and said, you know what? This is the best VR we ever tried. So we're going to give you the first check. So that was the first validation we had. And that was only about like 3 to 5 million. I mean, looking back, it wasn't that much. But to us at that time, it was like it was a saving grace. So we took that money and then we were able to build multiple locations. We had a project, we worked with IMAX, we did franchising. And then, you know, one of the bottlenecks we've gotten at that time was like, hey, your project is great, but I don't think it works outside of Asia. And that kind of pissed me off because I grew up in the US. I know this will work in the US. So I decided, you know what, we're going to put it in the middle of Silicon Valley. So we put it in San Mateo in the Hillsdale Mall. That was in June of 2018. And then that's when we pitched to Silicon Valley VCs. And it was a tough time too, because $3 million to do retail business, to build your own content, it's not a lot. And we pitched to 50 people before we went to Silicon Valley, and all of them said no. And I can understand why. It's a very, you know, unusual business of three things that investors don't want to invest in. But when we launched in Silicon Valley, same thing happened. You know, people heard about it. People want to be part of it. They were booking. We were like sold out for weekends. And then VC started to come. And then one day Andreessen Horowitz, I remember during a weekend, Mark Andreessen came to our location on a Sunday on flip-flops. And he just tried out the experience with Andrew Chen. And after he came out, he's like, whoa, this is pretty cool. And then the partnership came and played. And basically, they did a term sheet for Series A. And it created a lot of validation for us.
No kidding. I mean, when it comes to signaling and validation, when you have like a VC like that betting on you, how did that change things, you know, and how did you see a shift on the way that you were perceived by the VC community?
I think it went from before we got Andreessen funding, at least in the eyes of like general VCs or American VCs, it was like, oh yeah, Sandbox probably couldn't work because they're a team in, you know, based in Asia. They're doing something that's very schlubby with retail, with content, with VR. To, oh, Sandbox could work because they have a team in Asia. They're able to be very conscious of how they allocate their resource. And, you know, individually, you know, VR, gaming, and retail wouldn't work. But once you combine them, it's like 1 + 1 + 1 = 10. So it changes the whole narrative. And it created a lot of validation for us across many facets in terms of, you know, getting IPs. Soon after, we got in an IP for Star Trek. For real estate, we started to work with Brookfield and Westfield to bring Sandbox to other locations across the US. So, and then we also got an additional funding from celebrities, including Katy Perry, Will Smith, and Kevin Durant. So it just created a lot, it opened a lot of doors for us. And allows us to scale pretty aggressively. And that's basically what we've done. We went from one location in the US back in 2018 to about seven by the end of 2019. And we thought, okay, you know, we have all these locations open now, and then we're ready to do our Series B. And then 2020 happened. So that was basically the next hurdle of our entrepreneur's journey.
Yeah, no kidding, because I know that when COVID hit, almost you guys went to like nothing. So what happened there and how were you guys able to bounce back?
Essentially, we were pitching our Series B, meaning that we needed more capital to scale growth. And then, you know, soon we've learned that everything was in lockdown. We were told to shut down all our operations, all the locations that we had. We lost more than 100% of our revenue. Like, how do you go over 100%? Because we actually had to refund customer and we could not even open a store at all. So it was, it was really tough at that time. But I think fortunately, we were lucky to have good investors in Andreessen and in Alibaba and Gobi and Kraft to really get us over the hurdle. They gave us an emergency funding and they said, okay, why don't you guys fight through this and try to get out of it? Because fundamentally, their belief was, we also believed was, we had a great product. It's just where the world was right now. So as long as you can weather out the pandemic, you know, people are going to be pent up. They want to go out. They want to meet other people. They want to spend time with their friends and family, and they'll go to a sandbox. So we fought. But the first thing I had to do, which was really tough, was we had to let go 80% of our team. So, and not only that, after we let go of, you know, of the team, the people that stayed, we had to continue to motivate them to stay with the company. And that was really tough.
How do you do that? Because, I mean, obviously people are seeing that things are crumbling and people are leaving and you're letting go of people, you know, they're probably thinking, hey, we're going to be next. So how did you go about doing it, I think, with a level of transparency and authenticity so that the people that would stay, you know, would really stay and would be fully committed versus thinking, hey, I'm going to be next. I'd rather just have one foot out and start looking around. How did you guys go about balancing that?
And that did happen. For the folks that stayed, there were about another good amount that actually left in the next, you know, 3 to 5 months. So the first thing I did is we started with communication, like being very transparent about everything that's happening and just being no bullshit about it. That, like, look, we're in a really bad spot, right? This is the reality. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything because I think you deserve the truth. And then the next thing I'm going to say is, hey, we also have an investor that believe in us, right? Because this is the future that we want to build. And I give them a very clear plan. It's like, okay, this is what we're going to do in the next 12 months to get past this. And it's just a very clear outline of what our outcome is and how do we execute to it, which essentially was we had to cut costs to the bone, but this was an opportunity for us to really optimize our business. Every single facet of our store level P&L has been rigorously like inspected and optimized, right? Because when we can reopen and you have such an optimized P&L, then we're going to be able to grow very quickly out of it.
At what point do you see the clouds disappearing?
It was around when things really got better. It was around the beginning of 2021. So it was pretty much a 12-month process of just getting past that. And of course, during that time, we also had to go through Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Because we had all these leases that we could not fulfill and there was no way for us to pay it. So going through bankruptcy allowed us to restructure all our debt. But that was the only way to survive. And then we've been able to get out of that within 9 months. But during 2021, when the vaccination you know, started to kick in and then people felt much more comfortable reopening the world, what we've seen is, which was true, you know, 12 months before that, people were pent up. They want to go out. They want to have a reason to go out and they want to have a safe place to go out. And Sandbox was all of that. And I remember because all the malls were empty at that time, but 100% of our customers book ahead online. And then when they got into the mall, because it was so empty, we actually had to meet them at the parking lot to guide them to a store. But man, the moment they're in and they were playing our experience and coming out, sweating, laughing, having fun, they would tell us that they needed it. They needed this. So, and because, you know, we spent 12 months optimizing our P&L, these stores were phenomenally profitable. Numbers higher than some of the best retail businesses that ever that could have gotten. And because of these two in combination, we went to landlord and say, hey, you know, we've proven that we can get 80 to 100% of customers to book ahead and go to your location. And then because our economics are so strong, we can work out a deal with these landlords. So they end up funding the build-out for our subsequent stores.
So, I mean, here you are, you know, like bouncing back, you know, and now one thing that is like absolutely unbelievable is that you guys are now scaling like crazy. I think that for the talking about, you know, turning a corner here, for the people that are listening to get an idea on the scope and size right now of the operation, I mean, anything that you can share that you feel comfortable with?
You know, we have over 100,000 customer every month now. I mean, as a company, we're expected to hit, you know, over $70 million this year.
Wow.
You know, back in 2020, we were just, because of the shutdown, we were just a couple million dollars in revenue. So we went a really long way going from where we were. And we were, you know, had to go through Chapter 11. We could have died during that process.
No kidding. So now, obviously, it sounds like blue skies ahead, Steve, which is incredible. I guess, as you are thinking ahead and thinking into the future, if I was to ask you, you know, if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Sandbox VR is fully realized, what does that world look like?
There will be a sandbox in every neighborhood. We'll have new content releases every single week. And, you know, we'll work with some of the biggest IP holders to bring their world into Sandbox as well as creators. And there will be a reason for people to go out more and build these, you know, human-to-human connection. I mean, that's our vision. And if we can fulfill that, you know, for us, it's like becoming the new movies.
That's beautiful. So obviously, you know, that's talking about the future. I want to talk about the past, but talking about the past with a lens of reflection. If I was to put you into a time machine, and let's say I bring you back in time, you know, I bring you back in time to that moment where you were still, you know, at UC San Diego, you know, getting your degree there in electrical and electronics engineering. You know, let's say it's about 2005, where you're about to get your degree and to venture into the world of being an entrepreneur. And let's say right there on the ceremony of getting your graduation, you know, you're able to sit down next to your younger self and you're able to, you know, tap that younger Steve and give that younger Steve one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I would say a lot of knowledge can be taken from what other people write about. So one of the pieces of advice I would give is read a lot. Read the success and failures from others so you can incorporate them into your own repertoire.
That's beautiful. Now, as they say, you know, like history too repeats. So there's nothing like getting influenced now by and inspired by, you know, other stuff that you have around you. So one thing, Steve, here that I'd like to do is I'd like to thank you for the incredible, you know, time that you've graciously, you know, given us. And truly, it has been an honor to have you with us. So thank you so much for taking the time to be on the Dealmaker Show today, Steve.
Well, thank you for having me, Alejandro. And thank you for your time.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.